Hello, and welcome to the Women Who Code podcast. This show features conversations between diverse technology professionals discussing women in the industry, cutting-edge innovations, the future of work, deeply technical topics, and the ways that we can all work together to make the world a more inclusive place. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please subscribe, rate, and comment.
My name is Liana Novitz, and I'm a director for Women Who Code East Bay. And today we're interviewing Jackie Brossimer, head of data and machine learning platform engineering at Block. She leads a software engineering team that provides infrastructure to power streaming data and machine learning experiences for diverse business use cases across Square, Cash App, Tidal, and Afterpay. Before joining Block, Jackie worked in quantitative finance and scientific computing and received her PhD in high energy physics from UC Berkeley. Can you tell us more about your career journey and what led you to Block, especially about your transition from physics to data infrastructure?
Yeah, while it may look from my resume that I've had just kind of a random collection of jobs, it actually, I think, has had a pretty consistent theme around this passion I've always had for understanding and finding patterns and finding new use cases in big sets of data. And so I started out in physics, where I was doing a lot of analysis of data sets where we were trying to find new particles. And there's a lot of really interesting computational techniques there. After undergrad, I ended up working in finance for a few years. And that was a really great experience to kind of learn more about like the working world. And well, I found that it wasn't quite the right cultural fit. It really set me up for success when I returned back to grad school in physics at UC Berkeley, where I spent some time working on the Large Hadron Collider, which is an experiment in Switzerland where they try to smash particles together really fast and see what happens. And what happens is lots and lots of data that you need to use sophisticated techniques like machine learning on. And so I was really able to get a lot of practice working with really high scale data sets there. And while I was in grad school at Berkeley, which is really close to kind of the heart of Silicon Valley, I discovered that there was this like new cool thing called data science and machine learning. And then that was really becoming a trend in the industry. And so I started exploring more of what that might look like for a career after grad school. I ended up starting a workshop with some other grad students where we had grad students work on kind of taking all these computational skills that they already had and figuring out how to apply those to more traditional tech projects. And as part of that, I got a bunch of industry mentors that were already working in data science and machine learning to partner with some of these grad students. And that's actually ultimately how I ended up learning about Block through one of those mentors who worked there. After grad school, I interviewed at a bunch of different tech companies and found that Block was really the best fit for me. I really loved the people and I was really passionate about this mission of financial empowerment that the company is driven by, and I've been there ever since.
That's awesome. And now that you've been at Block for how many years has it been?
8 years.
Oh, wow.
Okay. 8 years.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your current role at Block, even though it's changed a lot over the past 8 years, particularly around the responsibilities of the data and machine learning platform team?
Yeah, when I started at Block, I was one of the first machine learning engineers on our small business lending product. And one of the things that's really kept me at the company is I feel like I've had almost a new job every couple years until then. So I grew up a team and started managing people on that lending team, and then did a bunch of different things kind of related to financing. And then during the pandemic, there was a bunch of shifts in our business where my role kind of changed a little bit. And I realized that what I was really passionate about was pursuing something that was a little more technical. And so I ended up taking this platform role. And it's been really unique because I think I've been able to bring that perspective of what it's like to, you know, really work at a product at Block to that infrastructure team that's kind of helping to support these products. And so it's really been an ideal role because I'm able to provide all this value of kind of knowing how the company works and knowing what our internal customers, meaning other teams that are trying to build products, need while still getting to learn from my team every day, which is my favorite part of my job, that all of these brilliant people work with me and I get to, you know, learn from the best in a way. What does the day-to-day look like in my current role? I spend a lot of time with my team making sure the most important part of my job is to make sure that we're working on the right things. And so I spend a lot of time with the team really understanding, you know, what their work is and specifically how the work between different teams fits together, which I think is really, really important for a cohesive platform to make sure that, you know, when someone comes to our internal platform and they want to do something like find a new data set to publish, that it feels it, you can't tell when you're working in, you know, one sprint team system versus another sprint team system, that entire experience is really seamless. I also spend a lot of time with stakeholders that are outside of my immediate team, kind of spread across the company through all these different business units, Square, Cash App, Tidal, TBD, really understanding where are all those stakeholders going in terms of what they're thinking for the product and the business, and how can we make sure that our infrastructure strategy is going to support that, you know, this year, next year, even beyond. One thing that can be a little bit challenging with infrastructure is you kind of need to be ahead of where the business is going, because, you know, if someone says, hey, I want to launch a new product next month, you don't always have enough lead time to spin up an entirely like new infrastructure component. And so to some degree, we kind of have to guess where the business is going and try to make sure that we're already there by the time that they're ready to ship.
The last thing you mentioned around if somebody is only giving you like a month lead time for a new product launch, how does that impact your day to day? Like when somebody comes to you and says that?
So I view the work of our team as kind of falling into two buckets. One is kind of like these long-term investments that are a little less directly driven by a product coming and saying, hey, I need this thing right now. And so we're always thinking about where do we want to be in 2 years and 3 years and 5 years. And a lot of my team offsites and in-person time is spent whiteboarding. And I think whiteboarding is one of the things that I miss the most about working in person. And so we do a lot of work to like literally draw out what is our architecture vision look like in 5 years, so that we make sure that we're always kind of driving towards that. And then hopefully if we're doing a good job, in kind of envisioning how that long-term technical architecture needs to evolve, then we've generalized our platform enough to support any new use cases that might come in. And then, you know, hopefully when someone says, hey, I need to launch this new product next month, we're able to pull into that remaining bucket of work that I mentioned. There's two, right? One of them is going to be long-term. One of them is going to be short-term. Short-term ends up being kind of this more like reactive versus proactive work, where someone comes and says, hey, I need to launch this product next month. And we are able to kind of fill the gap between that is hopefully not very wide from where the platform that we'd kind of envisioned is, and then, you know, where this particular need is. And so it's really about making sure that you have that right balance between proactive and reactive work, so that you're able to respond to needs that you might not have anticipated and needs that you did anticipate.
And to go into specifics a little bit more, what kinds of tools do you use to make sure that your team can remain flexible with new use cases?
I think one of the really interesting pivots that I've experienced during my time at this company has been kind of shift from a lot more sort of server-based technologies to where everything's in the data center, to kind of this new world that we're all living in, often called like the modern data stack, where everything's cloud-based and serverless and, you know, kind of has a lot of these scaling principles built in. And those mean that we like focus on very different things. Part of that is we've transitioned to buying versus building in a lot of places over the last few years as we've looked at, you know, our business more holistically and said like, hey, like a lot of these, you know, data infrastructure components are not really needs that are particularly unique in our company. And so we can just use something that's off the shelf, whereas something that's going to be really close to payments or lending or AI, something that's, you know, really at the heart of our business, we're always going to kind of want to build those ourselves. And because we've kind of shifted a lot of those fundamental components closer to vendor products with clouds like AWS and GCP, we've been able to spend a lot more time with kind of the same team focusing on those like really innovative pieces. And one of the things that's obviously come up a lot this year and for everyone in the field has been AI. And so because we've built this really strong data infrastructure that's really flexible, we've been really prepared to not only take advantage of new product opportunities, but also new technology opportunities, like a lot of the developments that have happened in the last year or two.
Thank you. So as far as developing solutions, does your team have a central ethos or mantra that drives how you collaborate across the business?
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important, given that Block is a very bottoms-up company, so we don't necessarily have, you know, this very waterfall process where everyone decides, you know, how we're going to be moving over the next few years. Instead, it's a very iterative thing, is making sure that we build that iteration into the way we work. And so I don't know if anyone's ever seen that like illustration of skateboard to bicycle to car, but that's something that I bring up a lot in our team meetings. And I talk about making sure that we have kind of small, useful components that we can then iterate on. And so an anti-pattern that I've observed with infrastructure teams is trying to be perfect. So I'm going to go away and take 2 years and build like a data platform that will solve all of your needs. It turns out during those 2 years, those needs end up changing. And so instead of that kind of more waterfall mode, I really push my teams to operate in this kind of agile way where we're constantly iterating. And so what that looks like instead is having, you know, a really quick MVP, that skateboard in that drawing that I was referencing, that we can kind of get up and working and start playing with. And then after that, what we usually do is we start partnering with one or two internal customers to start working on that MVP with us. And there's usually still some rough edges, but we're able to start onboarding people immediately and start getting that immediate feedback about whether or not what we're building is actually meeting their needs. And then from there, we usually have what we call like a beta launch internally, where we have a smaller group of customers that we're not being as hands-on with, but are still kind of helping us test and flesh out those rough edges. And then we use that beta group to kind of figure out what self-serve looks like. Self-serve is a really important principle in our team because we're a relatively small team that's serving a giant company of engineers. So my team has a couple hundred people, but there are thousands of engineers across the company. So we obviously don't have time to, you know, like one-on-one pair with all of them. And so we really try to emphasize having really good self-serve. And as part of that, really good automation. So we make it really easy to do the right thing. And then, you know, hopefully through automation, make it a little bit harder to make mistakes that could have bad consequences. And then we kind of consider things fully GA, even though GA is, you know, for us, usually an internal release. Once we've gotten that automation and self-serve story really sorted out and other engineers can onboard onto our platform without needing a lot of handholding from the platform team.
Perfect. That sounds like a very tight-knit process that I'm sure a lot of other teams should follow. You mentioned already that you miss whiteboarding. So as engineering teams are imagining possibilities for their culture, how can they ensure that the shared vision is inclusive, inventive, and future-proof?
I think when I think about culture, I guess what I always think about first is people and thinking about, you know, how are we building up teams, both through hiring and organization, so that everyone is in a place where they are, you know, contributing the most that they can to the group. I think a really, really big piece of that is diversity. And I think diversity kind of ends up having a lot more dimensions than we often talk about. Of course, there's all the, you know, kind of protected classes that we always put a lot of focus on when we're reporting on diversity. But when I'm hiring, I try to think a lot more holistically than that and think about not just, you know, what are someone's like demographics, but also thinking a lot about like, what is their background? In my area, particularly thinking about like, do they have a traditional software background or something a little bit more non-traditional? What kind of engineer are they? Are they someone who's really slow and careful and always going to, you know, make sure that they've checked everything, you know, three times? Or are they someone who's kind of a little bit more of that startup mindset where they want to go really quickly to prototype something, but there might be some rough edges there? also making sure that we have a balance of expertise, looking at this team, like, do we need more expertise in Kafka, or, you know, is Spark something that the team needs to learn about? And all of these things, I think, are really important balances. You never want on any engineering team to have like too much of one kind of thinking, because that kind of defeats the purpose of a team, in my opinion. And so when I'm hiring, I'm really, really thoughtful about understanding, you know, where's this team at right now? And what needs to be like, what's kind of like the missing ingredient for us to get the team to that like next level of performance, by making sure that we're kind of like a well-balanced algorithm of people to make decisions. And then of course, like, it, you know, it's about more than just hiring, right? I also spend a lot of time coaching, especially I personally spend like an extra amount of time, I think, relative to a lot of people in my similar jobs, partnering with tech leads. I think especially, you know, now that we've moved into a remote environment, making sure that everyone's really aligned on what is that like big picture vision, what is that architecture we're trying to build to in 5 years, and making sure that people are bringing that into their daily work is very important. So I spend a lot of time coaching tech leads, who I feel like are some of the people who make like the biggest difference in individual contributor engineers' day-to-day lives. It's not, in my opinion, like sufficient for like just managers to kind of understand where we're going. I think it's really important for everyone to understand where we're going.
You mentioned tech leads. So I'm curious, do you find that there's a good ratio of individual contributors to tech lead?
Yeah, I think everyone's going to have, you know, a different opinion on this. And of course, every company kind of defines tech lead and manager a little bit differently. What I found, I think, works really well is to kind of have relatively small little squads, not even quite a team. So meaning, you know, like around 5 engineers, partnering really closely with a senior tech lead who can really help those more junior engineers on a day-to-day basis, you know, with pairing, with pull requests, with helping to manage like day-to-day sprint stuff in a way that a manager who might have, you know, a lot more reports than that can't always provide that hands-on support.
That makes a lot of sense. I appreciate you mentioning the role of tech leads in helping junior engineers level up. So where do you see the fintech industry going as it evolves and becomes more innovative and inclusive?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really exciting things that have changed over the last 5 years, and I'm sure even more will change over the next 5. So a really big trend that everybody's talking about right now, and is obviously very relevant to my background, is all the stuff that's happened with generative AI. I think it'll be really interesting from like a platform perspective. You know, I think it's really interesting to think about how can AI kind of help to smooth out some of these seams in our user experience and make automation really easy? How can it make the boring parts of the job that people are kind of more resistant to doing, things like migrations, which are always present in my particular line of work, how can we make those really easy and fun? I think another thing that's going to start happening, and I don't have an answer about what to do with this, is there's a lot of changes happening in regulations over the next few years that I think are going to impact fintech a lot specifically. And so it'll be really interesting to see how that evolves. And of course, you know, regulation around AI is also going to be a big change over the next few years. And I think there's kind of this move right now where regulation is getting more and more fragmented, and it'll be interesting to see if that changes at all as it becomes harder and harder to keep up with.
Right. And are you responsible for keeping up to date with all these regulations, or do you have somebody else on your team that is supposed to keep track?
Yeah, we have, we partner with a lot of different, one of the things I love most about my job is I get to partner with like almost every function in the company, I think it feels like sometimes. And so we partner really closely with compliance teams, legal teams that are kind of on the front lines of understanding these regulations and what they mean. And then of course, we have to kind of work really closely with them to bring the understanding of the technical systems and help figure out how some of these new regulations might end up getting implemented kind of on the ground when it comes to really specific like engineering requirements. And so it's always a partnership. And I think one of the most important things in any cross-functional partnership is communication. So making sure that you can, you know, translate between like lawyer speak and engineering speak, which I think is often a career skill that gets a little bit shorted when we think about like how to build up an engineering career. We talk a lot about, if we talk about communication, I feel like it often ends up being a little bit more about like how to communicate with other engineers or, you know, how to communicate with product managers. But at least in my role, I have to go like pretty far beyond that and be able to communicate with all sorts of people, including people who are very, very non-technical, and trying to find that ability to simplify things so that they can really understand the crux of it and the piece of the technology that really matters to their concern is really important.
Thank you so much for sharing. And as far as outside of work, would you like to maybe tell us what you're passionate about?
Yeah, I have a lot of, you know, hobbies that are probably not uncommon to people in my role, like reading and that sort of stuff. But one of, I think, the more unusual hobbies that I have is a couple years ago, I actually moved from the Bay Area to just outside Seattle, where I now own a small horse farm. And so it's basically like a small business in my backyard where people can pay to keep their horses. And it's been really great to have, especially in remote work, that balance between something where I get to go work outside and it's very concrete and it's like very different than sort of my day-to-day work at Block to kind of balance out those energy levels.
Very cool. I want to come. And for women in tech looking to become a leader in their field, can you share any pro tips?
Yeah, I mean, I can share the tips that have worked for me. I think, you know, it's always going to be a little bit different for everyone. I've always tried to really make sure that I'm optimizing for making impact over everything else, over, you know, impressing my boss, over, you know, getting a certain title on my resume or anything like that. And that's always served me really well. And that's one of the reasons I've stayed at Block so long, is I've always felt like I've really been rewarded for having that impact. And it's always, you know, I've always been recognized for, I guess, the things I want to be recognized for. But I think early in your career, it can be like really hard to know like what to aim for. And especially, I know a big transition point for a lot of people is kind of going from like an individual contributor to a manager. And I remember when I was doing that, I'm like, well, I'm only going to have, you know, one chance to do that. And it turns out like you're actually going to have a lot of chances to do that. And so over any one title, over any one opportunity, I always like advise people early on in their careers to really optimize for figuring out how to make impact and then also for learning. And then if you're in an environment that's, you know, the right environment for you, then all those things that are kind of, you know, more indicating of status, like, are you a manager? You know, what is your title? You know, all those kind of external facing things, they should be following from that impact that you're driving towards. And if that's not happening, then it might not be the right environment for you.
For people that aren't sure whether they want to be a manager, like myself, is there some telltale sign that you think is an indicator that people should become a manager?
I think if you want to be a manager, I think you like have to really understand like the pros and the cons. I think a lot of people see it as a promotion, but one of the things I really like about working at Block is we, you know, have two different career ladders that are kind of seen as equal, and you can, you know, kind of get promoted all the way to the top of it by just being an IC. So I think the first thing I like to encourage people to do is like make sure that you don't want to become a manager just because it feels like a promotion. That's like, I guess, a telltale sign that you're doing it for the wrong reasons. But I think there are a lot of right reasons to do it, and that's going to end up being really personal to you. Why I'm a manager is because I really love helping people, and I really love helping the people that work for me. And to me, that's the most rewarding thing, is seeing, you know, my team being happy, my team being successful, my team being high performing and working on the right stuff. And so I also really advise, before like, you know, taking that leap to become manager, I think there's a lot of ways to kind of practice some of those skills. You know, so practice being in charge of a project, practice mentoring people, and really pay attention to how those things feel for you. And if it feels draining, like there are a lot of really draining parts of being a manager, right? And so if all of those things feel draining, then like maybe it's not for you. But if, you know, some of those things feel draining, like you really don't like project management meetings, but you get a lot of energy from mentoring people, then, you know, that might end up being something that you want to explore. Manager jobs are also not kind of one size fits all. There's going to be, you know, a kind of different balance of what you're doing and what you're not doing and what you're delegating and what you're taking on yourself. So that period of discovery can be really important because it kind of helps you figure out how to customize that job once you get there. I think I've also like helped a lot of people in their careers, like go from managers, like back to ICs, including some of the, you know, more senior people in my group. I think whenever there's a really good engineer, the manager's instinct is always to try to like promote them to being a manager. But I think, again, to my answer earlier, it's like really important that that's for the right reasons. So I've definitely had managers under me who are performing really well, but, you know, after having career talks with them, I've learned that that's not really what they're passionate about. And so I've, you know, made that change based on understanding, you know, what their personal goals are and helping them to get a little bit closer to what they actually want versus, you know, kind of what other people want for them.
Thank you for explaining that. So is there anything else you'd like to share today before we end?
No, thank you so much for taking the time. This is great.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Thank you for listening to the Women Who Code podcast. To find out more about our mission and the work we do across the tech industry, visit our website at www.womenwhocode.com. You can also follow us on all socials at Women Who Code. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, Women Who Code, with hundreds of hours of free educational videos. Thanks again for listening, and remember to subscribe, rate, and comment.